Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from the archives of True West Magazine. This publication was printed in November 1985. Mark Twain in the West by Roy Meder. November 30th marks the 150th anniversary of Samuel Longhorn Clemens's birth. This year is also the centennial of Huckleberry Finn's publication. True West celebrates those anniversaries with a retrospective on Mark Twain's life in the West. During his busy Western years, Samuel Clemens twice found it expedient to leave town in a hurry. On May 29th, 1864, he caught the stage from Virginia City to California to avoid prosecution in Nevada Territory for illegal dueling. In December 1864, with San Francisco lawmen looking for him, he had reason to lie low at the gold camps in Tulum County, east of the city. There he tried prospecting again with no luck. But he finally struck pay dirt when he overheard a yarn about a frog. In time, he would ride that remarkable Western frog to success, riches, and renown. Operating in Western mining camps and cities, Clemens saw fit on occasion to adopt an alias. The names he chose, though, hardly made him inconspicuous. Quintus Curtius Snodgrass, W. Epaminondas Adrastus Blab, and simply Josh. Despite those sinister activities, he wasn't a bank robber, con man, gambler, highwayman, or bunco artist. He was something even more threatening, and threatened in the West, a journalist. He was inept with a gun, but quick and deadly with a pen, which sometimes had a more devastating and lasting effect. One of the names he signed to his newspaper and magazine pieces in Nevada and California stayed with him for life. The world has never forgotten it. He took it from his memories of earlier days as a riverboat pilot on the Mississippi. He remembered leadsmen shouting the words, "Like music to signal the depth of the river, Mark Twain." Captain Isaiah Sellers, before him, had used the name for a column of Mississippi River News. The second Mark Twain explained, he died in 1863, and as he could no longer need that signature, I laid violent hands upon it without asking permission. That is the history of the nom de plume I bear. Twain began his life as Samuel Langhorn Clemens on November 30th, 1835, at Florida, Missouri, a small village west of the Mississippi. The 150th anniversary of his birth is being commemorated worldwide this month. Those who want to understand life in the early West have more reason than most to cherish Twain. He served as a frontier reporter, chronicler, critic, storyteller, and humorist. In the process, his stories about the West and his style, shaped by life in the West, made him America's favorite author. In Roughing It and many of his other writings, he captured the flavor, reality, and laughter of the West as no writer since. Clemens spent his childhood absorbing experiences raw and whole on the western frontier of the 1840s at Hannibal, Missouri. The town was on the banks of the Mississippi, northwest of St. Louis. He romanticized his hometown in various writings, especially The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. In his boyhood, the men routinely wore revolvers and knives on the street, and violence was no stranger. On January 24th, 1845, William Oldsby shot Sam Smar in cold blood, and Sam Clemens, age 9, saw Owsley contemptuously dismiss the mob that came to string him up. Mark Twain used the event to create a memorable chapter in Huckleberry Finn, where Colonel Sherburne derides his lynch mob and says with a scorn, A man safe in the hands of 10,000 of your kind, as long as it's daytime and you're not behind him. At the age of 12, Clemens was apprenticed to a Hannibal printer. He called the move his first step into the literary profession. Board and clothes were his first wages. More board than clothes, he reported. During the 1850s, he worked as a journeyman printer in various cities, including New York and Philadelphia, as had Benjamin Franklin in the 18th century. He leapt at a chance to learn the Mississippi under master pilot Horace Bixby, and was certified April 9, 1859, to pilot Mississippi steamboats. He called river piloting adventurous play, but when the Civil War started, river traffic stopped, and so did Clemens's salaried play. Before heading west to try his luck at prospecting, Clemens served 3 curious weeks on active duty in the Civil War. He joined the Confederacy in Rawls County, Missouri, along with 14 others in a volunteer outfit charged with protecting Missouri against invaders. His closest brush with military glory, he claimed, was almost being captured by Colonel Ulysses S. Grant. He quit the war after less than 3 weeks' service, stating later that he was incapacitated by fatigue through persistent retreating. On July 25, 1861, accompanied by his brother, Orion Clemens, who was going west to serve as Secretary of Nevada Territory, Sam boarded the overland stage at St. Joseph, Missouri, for the rigorous 20-day trip to Carson City, Nevada. Sam paid the fares, which came to $150 each, one way, with 25 pounds of luggage allowed per passenger. George Bemis, a stranger to the Clemens brothers, was the third passenger. The accident of catching that particular stage earned Bemis a friendly mention in Roughing It and a permanent place in Western literature. Years afterward, in his popular stage lecture based on Roughing It, Twain colorfully described the long cross-continent journey by stage as an ordeal going on day and night through sagebrush, over sand and alkali plains, wolves and Indians, starvation and smallpox, everything to make the journey interesting. He admitted having a splendid time and must have been exceedingly attentive, taking mental and written notes of everything he saw. Clemens was armed for the crossing with a little Smith & Wesson 7-shooter. He considered it a dangerous weapon with only one fault. You could not hit anything with it. That may have been in part due to the marksman. During his military career, he and 5 others fired simultaneously at an enemy soldier who was unharmed by the barrage. Orion Clemens carried a Colt revolver, and Bemis had an old Allen revolver, which would fetch something else if it didn't hit its target. This was proved when Bemis fired at a deuce of spades on a tree and wounded a mule 30 yards to the left, according to Mark Twain in Roughing It. Maybe hostile Indians and outlaws sensed how well the travelers could defend themselves. The stage went unmolested during its passage to Carson City, a 3-year-old mining boomtown named for Kit Carson. Clemens and his brother paid $50 a week for room and board at Bridget O'Flanagan's boarding house. Orion began his job, and Clemens made his first painful experiments with prospecting. I had supposed in my innocence that silver mining was nice, easy business, Twain wrote. He was misinformed. He learned that a miner's life was one of hard work, a development for which he frankly had not planned. To distract himself from the hardships of mining, he roamed Carson City, admiring the novel traits of the local people. Among them was their magnificent ability to ride horses. I soon learned to tell a horse from a cow, and I was just burning to learn more, Mark Twain reported. An auctioneer's brother helped him acquire a genuine Mexican plug that could outbuck any horse in America. He promptly learned what bucking was. I got on him. As soon as they let go, He put all his feet together in a bunch. He let his back sag down, and then he arched it suddenly and shot me 180 yards into the air. I wasn't used to such things. Twain apparently never took to early rising or horses. Questioning the maxim that early birds catch worms, he advised, "Don't be fooled by this absurd saw. I once knew a man who tried it. He got up at sunrise and a horse bit him." Clemens began writing letters about people and events in Carson City, signing them Josh, and sending them to the Territorial Enterprise in Virginia City. San Francisco printers Joseph T. Goodman and Dennis McCarthy bought the newspaper for $214 when it went bankrupt. They made it a hard-hitting daily, guaranteeing in their first editorial to keep the universe thoroughly posted concerning murders and street fights and balls and theaters and pack trains and churches and so on for a long list. The letters from Josh impressed Goodman, the Enterprise editor. They were humorous, imaginative, exuberant, cleverly worded. They contained sharp points and were just the sort of material to carry the day with Western readers. In one of the shrewdest decisions an editor ever made, Goodman offered Josh a job on the Enterprise. Nearly broke and fed up with mining labors, Clemens walked the 130 miles to Virginia City. He hired on at $25 per week to write two columns for each issue. He was to use the reporter's basic technique of asking around. Virginia City, founded in 1859, was the ultimate Western mining boomtown, lusty and untamed. Mine tunnels ran under the streets and buildings. Thousands of workers steadily toiled to extract precious metal from the Comstock lode, one of the richest veins in history. The camp had money in abundance, men on the make, and too few women. It was a wild town in a wild time, and Mark Twain was soon thriving in the thick of it. For him, Virginia City was a perpetual wild party, a stag dinner, a splendid riot. His newspaper pieces suited the atmosphere of the place perfectly. When real news was in short supply, he dreamed up burlesques to amuse the miners. One of his newspaper hoaxes about a petrified man was picked up by other papers across the country and printed as fact. Embellishment was the accepted rule, even with a genuine story. Mark Twain saw one man shoot another. "I stepped right up there and got the victim to give me his last words exclusively for the Enterprise, and I added some more to them so as to be sure and get ahead of the other papers," he wrote. He then thanked the desperado who won the argument and tried to borrow half a dollar from him. Because of the shortage of women, Clemens served Virginia City in another way. A small man, he wore a handkerchief armband as one of the ladies when the miners had a dance. Twain found the absence of women and families from the mining camps especially poignant. He wrote of a miner just down from long isolation in the mountains who paid $150 in gold dust to kiss a three-year-old baby. He saw other miners flock in crowds to catch a glimpse of that rare and blessed spectacle, a woman. Writing for the Enterprise and soon other Western publications, Twain quickly became one of the most popular journalists in Northern California and the Washoe Gold Camp region of Nevada. In 1863, he first used the pen name Mark Twain when reporting on the territorial legislature, which he called the Grand Bull Drivers Convention. In Virginia City, San Francisco, and surrounding areas, his success earned him the flamboyant titles Washoe Giant and the Wild Humorist of the Pacific Slope. In April 1864, Mark Twain ran the Enterprise while Goodman was away in San Francisco. That led to trouble. To enliven local journalism, he and the publisher of the Virginia Union began trading insults in their publications. With encouragement from others, a duel was arranged. possibly as an antidote to boredom in a period of relative calm. The duel itself faded away into a farce no one took seriously, but Mark Twain used the event as an excuse to move on. Dueling was illegal and carried a 2-year penalty. With his friend Steve Gillis, he caught the stage to California. Virginia City had given him a chance to prove and develop his skills as a reporter and storyteller. He remembered the rough, boisterous camp with gratitude and wrote about it in kindly fashion. But he was ready to try his skills on bigger challenges. In San Francisco, he first stayed at the Swank Occidental Hotel, expecting optimistically to make a killing on Nevada silver mining stocks. Instead, he went broke again, moved to cheaper lodgings, pawned his possessions, and became a reporter on the San Francisco Morning Call. Reporting is the best school in the world to get a knowledge of human beings, human nature, and human ways, he noted in retrospect. But the work of reporting for a city newspaper, with its emphasis on accuracy, must not have been altogether to his liking. He worked on the Morning Call from June to October 1864, and then, being too cavalier about facts and working hours, was replaced by a reporter he identified as Smiggy McGlural. With Smiggy McGlural in and Mark Twain out, the Washoe Giant knew hard times once more. His friend Bret Hart came partially to the rescue. He offered Twain a part-time job as a staff writer at $12 per week on the Californian, which Hart edited. Twain supplemented that meager income by serving as the San Francisco correspondent for the Enterprise and contributing articles to a weekly publication in San Francisco, The Golden Era. An important vehicle for Western authors, The Golden Era had been the first San Francisco journal to publish Mark Twain's work while he was still in Virginia City. It also published stories about the California frontier by Bret Hart, who developed into Mark Twain's closest rival as the West's leading author. Twain later credited Hart with helping start his career, admitting, "Bret Hart trimmed and trained and schooled me patiently." In San Francisco, Clemens occasionally played penny ante poker with a man named Tom Sawyer. Sawyer erected a sign on his tavern at 3rd and Mission Streets, declaring, "The original Tom Sawyer, proprietor." When Mark Twain gave the name international significance in 1876. As his popularity and confidence grew in San Francisco, Twain also displayed a crusading spirit in his writing and began championing underdogs. He accused the San Francisco police of brutality against the Chinese. One man arrested for stealing flour sacks died in prison, and Mark Twain wrote that he lay with that calm serenity which is peculiar to men whose heads have been caved in with a club. Such comments in his Enterprise communications earned the wrath of the authorities, and to avoid violence, Twain temporarily moved to the gold camps. The threat to his well-being was neither idle nor imagined. Journalists who expressed themselves too frankly were fair game in San Francisco. Visiting the city in 1880, Robert Louis Stevenson saw a San Francisco editor shot on the street. Another editor routinely traveled with a bodyguard. Quick-tempered and outspoken newspaper columnist Ambrose Bierce wore a revolver, knew how to use it from his service in the Civil War, and announced himself permanently ready to go farther into the matter with those who disliked what he wrote. Mark Twain, a poor shot, could not afford to be so touchy about criticism. On December 4th, 1864, he joined Dick Stoker and Jim Gillis at their cabin in Jackhouse Hill near Tuttletown. Gillis was a master relator of tall tales, and Mark Twain repeated those that were suitable for public consumption. Twain noted that the stories were never as hilarious in print as when Gillis told them in the mountain cabin. While visiting Stoker and Gillis, Mark Twain tried working a gold claim and for the last time ended up with sore muscles and empty pockets. He alleged, as doleful miners often did, that he quit just short of a rich strike others made in the same place. Melancholy over his lack of success with mining, he turned for solace to the Angels Camp Saloon, a few miles from Jackass Hill. Fate led him to the right place at the right time. He heard a story about a jumping frog that was filled with buckshot to make it lose a contest. The yarn proved to contain more gold than most miners took from the earth in a lifetime. Mark Twain ornamented the bare facts. He named the frog Dan L. Webster, added other characters, and created that perpetual Western favorite, the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County. The story was published in the New York Saturday Press November 18, 1865, and it earned Mark Twain his first nationwide audience. When he took to the lecture stage, posters advertising Mark Twain's appearance often showed him triumphantly riding a large frog. Mark Twain took full advantage of the opportunities won for him by Dan L. Webster, but he came to consider the relationship irksome. Playing second fiddle to a frog wounded his pride. To think that after writing many an article, a man might be excused for thinking tolerably good, those New York people should single out a villainous Blackwood sketch to compliment me on, he grumbled. In 1866, Twain represented the Sacramento Union for a series of articles from the Sandwich Islands, Hawaii. Back in San Francisco by fall, he found himself in familiar circumstances, without means and without employment. A public lecture about the Sandwich Islands might be a solution, but it was a long shot. Friends advised against it because he had never spoken in public. There are times, however, to ignore good advice from friends and go ahead. Twain rented McQuire's Academy of Music for $50, advertised that the trouble begins at 8 o'clock on Tuesday, October 2nd, 1866, and arranged for a clack to simulate laughter. Planting hired laughers and applauders in the audience was wasted effort. The performance was a sellout. Mark Twain was brilliant. The bold experiment was a startling triumph. He cleared $400 for the single event, a sizable figure at the time. Twain had discovered a ready way to supplement his income from writing. From that day to this, I have always been able to gain my living without doing any work, he wrote later. In 1866, Mark Twain had the Western lecture market all to himself, and he promptly made a grand tour in California and Nevada to discuss our fellow savages of the Sandwich Islands. At Red Dog Camp, Mark Twain particularly liked the introduction by a friend who said, I know only two things about Mark Twain. One is that he has never been in the penitentiary. And another is, I can't imagine why. Since the jumping frog had made him well known in the East, Twain decided to follow Dan L. Webster and take his lecture act to Virgin Territory. With passage booked on the steamer America, departing San Francisco, December 15, 1866, Mark Twain gave a farewell lecture in San Francisco on December 5th. He addressed San Francisco that night, but what he said was a prophecy for the West. This sparsely populated land shall become a crowded hive of busy men. Your waste places shall blossom like the rose, and your deserted hills and valleys shall yield bread and wine for unnumbered thousands. Railroads shall be spread hither and thither and carry the invigorating blood of commerce to regions that are languishing now. A splendid prosperity shall descend like a glory upon the whole land. After he journeyed east in 1866, the West had to share Mark Twain with the rest of the world. The West had shaped him, provided the matter of his stories, allowed him to find his voice. With the distance of time and geography to focus his vision, he wrote about the West and gave literary permanence to the era. He wrote about the places that faded away. The men are gone. The houses have vanished. Even the name of the place is forgotten. In no other land in modern times have towns so absolutely died and disappeared as in the old mining regions of California. Yet even ghost towns survive in Mark Twain's writing. The magnetic pull of the West seems never to have weakened for Mark Twain. Though he never returned after a final visit to California in 1868, he kept his West alive in books. He explained to a friend, "Those were the good old days, the old ones. They were so full to the brim with the wine of life. There have been no others like them. Would you like to have me come out there and cry?" The dream of returning to the West, where he had been exceedingly young, marvelously young, younger than I am now, younger than I shall ever be again, lingered on. Eventually called his greatest book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn was first published February 18, 1885, making 1985 Huck Finn's centennial year, as well as the author's sesquicentennial. At the end of the great narrative, Huck Finn looks to the West for freedom and new adventures. We needn't doubt that Huck spoke for himself and Mark Twain when he closed the book by saying, "I reckon I got to light out for the territory ahead of the rest because Aunt Sally, she's going to adopt me and civilize me, and I can't stand it. I have been there before." Twain wrote 9 chapters for a sequel to Huckleberry Finn, taking Huck and Tom Sawyer west among the Indians, but stopped in mid-sentence and never continued. We struck out on this trail and followed it a couple of days. The reasons he didn't go on with the tale aren't clear. Other demands may have intervened. He may have hit a snag in the plot that he couldn't get over. Or perhaps just then remembering how it was when days were full to the brim was too much. Twain's readers, however, can always revisit his West in Roughing It and in pages scattered throughout his many volumes. Thanks to his writing, Americans will forever be able to light out for the territory. True West Magazine, November 1991 edition. Deadly Deputy by R.K. DeArmett. Dan Tucker rode into Silver City, New Mexico Territory in 1875, just as Grant County Sheriff Harvey Whitehill was looking for a deputy. Whitehill was a large, imposing man, but he was compassionate to both the honest and lawless alike. He normally did not carry a gun and was not known to have ever killed anyone. He preferred to hire men of demonstrated leather-slapping ability to do his gun work. 26-year-old Tucker appeared to be such a man. Tucker was as ordinary in appearance as Whitehill was striking. One Silver City resident described him as slim-built, with blue eyes and light hair, and of a shy and retiring disposition. He was customarily attired in a dark sombrero, blue flannel shirt, overalls, and light calfskin boots. Nothing in his dress or demeanor distinguished him from hundreds of others arriving to join the district's new mining excitement. Born in Canada and a machinist by trade, he had been raised in Indiana and had come to Silver City from Colorado. Perhaps a few eyebrows were raised when Sheriff Whitehill pinned a deputy's badge on the soft-spoken young man, but rumors were already afloat that the new county officer was a dangerous man indeed. Some said that he had fled Colorado after stabbing a black man to death. Others were sure Whitehill had known Tucker in Colorado, had seen him in mortal action, and had sent for him. Whatever deeds lay on Dan Tucker's back trail, during his 13-year stay in Grant County, he would demonstrate on many occasions his skill with weapons and his willingness to use them. 7 years after Tucker's Silver City arrival, a newspaper man would attribute 11 killings to his quick gun in New Mexico. In a newspaper interview many years later, Wayne Whitehill, son of the sheriff, would say that Dan Tucker dispatched 21. Like most of the notch sticks credited to notorious gunmen of the Old West, Tucker's has no doubt been overcarved. However, during his New Mexico years, he was unquestionably the top gun in a very tough district. "I myself saw him kill two different men," recalled Wayne Whitehill in 1949. "There was a saloon in the dance hall on Broadway. It was filled with Mexicans. One of them stuck a knife into the back of another, then ran out of the saloon and up the street. Dan Tucker happened to come along. I was standing right beside him. He drew his six-shooter and, holding it with both hands, fired just as the man turned the corner. The shot hit the Mexican in the neck and killed him instantly." This was probably the same shooting witnessed by brothers Dan and Will Rose, youngsters about Wayne's age. Describing the incident some 60 years later, Dan Rose said the knife-wielding Mexican was running about 50 yards away and barely discernible in the dim light when Tucker fired. Spinning like a top, the man screamed once and fell to the street dead. The man he had knifed, one Belmudez, had been slashed across the abdomen and his intestines were hanging out. The doctor gathered them in his hands, washed and replaced them, then sewed up the wound. Belmudez lived 40 years longer. The other occasion when Wayne Whitehill saw Tucker in action resulted from a report that a Mexican was throwing rocks at people. When the deputy went to investigate, young Whitehill trotted after. Tucker located the rock thrower and, according to Whitehill, just popped him through the window and killed him. Dan Rose related a number of other undated and undocumented shootings in which he said Tucker engaged. There was the downing of a Mexican thief who would not stop to be arrested, and the shooting of three suspected horse thieves in a Silver City saloon, two of whom, mortally wounded, dropped to the barroom floor, while the other, made helpless by a bullet that grazed his skull and his desire to fight all gone, fell helpless by the side of his comrades. There were the two thieves who had looted the cabin of a prospector, stealing his money, provisions, weapons, and animals. Tucker is said to have taken the trail and returned 2 days later with the stolen stock and valuables. "They didn't want to come back," he reported. "I left them with the rancher. He'll bury them all right." Rose said Deputy Tucker was called to a house where a Mexican was murdering his wife and son. He had beaten them with a club and had begun to demolish the furniture when Tucker arrived. As Tucker, with his gun in his hand, entered the door, the Mexican brought his club down on the deputy's arm, knocking the gun to the floor. Quick as a flash, Tucker picked up the gun with his left hand and shot the Mexican dead. In late 1877, Tucker became involved in the complicated and murderous conflict known as the El Paso Salt War, which erupted in the Rio Grande Valley of West Texas. What began as an economic and political struggle over ownership rights to commercial salt beds some 120 miles east of El Paso degenerated into a vicious and bloody racial battle between white Texans and Mexican Americans, supported by Mexican nationals. In December, three Texans were killed in vicious fighting. Another three surrendered, only to be executed by a Mexican mob at San Elizario. A combined force of U.S. soldiers from Fort Bayard and a contingent of Texas Rangers seemed incapable of controlling the volatile situation. Sheriff Charles Kerber of El Paso County was authorized by Governor Richard Hubbard to raise a posse of fighting men. He turned for help to Silver City, which was known to be well-stocked with tough adventurers who would welcome an opportunity to battle Mexicans for $40 a month and forage. Dan Tucker was named captain of the expedition. Enlisting the aid of John Kenny, a notorious rustler and outlaw gun leader, he put together a force of some 30 warriors described by one historian as hard-faced and battle-scarred, and headed for El Paso. From there, on December 22nd, the contingent of U.S. Army troopers, Texas Rangers, and New Mexico mercenaries moved on to San Elizario. Several Mexicans suspected of involvement with the mob were killed, and a mass exodus across the border into Mexico ensued. The militant Mexicans, having evaporated, the Anglo force went into camp at Isleta. With no enemy upon which to vent their spleen, members of the patchwork army began to turn on each other. Quite an unfriendly feeling exists between the Rangers and United States troops stationed in El Paso County, understated a Silver City paper. On the first day of the new year of 1878, that unfriendly feeling burst into violence, and one posseman shot and killed another. 10 days later, Sheriff Kerber disbanded his posse, and the New Mexico mercenaries headed for home. In April 1878, Tucker, while still retaining his deputy sheriff's commission under Whitehill, was named the first city marshal at Silver City. By all accounts, Tucker kept the rough element under firm control during his 2 years he served as Silver City marshal. Only 3 months after his appointment, a local paper announced, "Marshal Tucker, under the city government, has put a stop to the discharge of firearms upon our streets." He narrowly escaped death at the hands of a drunk late in December 1879. City Marshal Dan Tucker was shot at last Tuesday night by a Mexican known as Carpio Rodriguez, said the Silver City Herald. The ball passed through the marshal's clothing, but fortunately did not touch his person. Rodriguez was intoxicated at the time and resisting arrest. In January 1880, Tucker turned in his city marshal's star to go to Shakespeare, a little town in the desert a few miles from Lordsburg. Shakespeare was enjoying a mining boom, and cattle range outlaws and mining camp toughs from both southern New Mexico and Arizona had made it their favorite watering hole. John Kenny's rustlers and San Simon gang of Curly Bill Brocius were threatening to take over the town. Whitehill dispatched his top gun deputy as a troubleshooter to cool things down. Tucker's adventures with the outlaws at Shakespeare have gone unrecorded except for his part the following year in the termination of the careers of Sandy King and Russian Bill, two members of the Curly Bill crowd. Russian Bill, whose name was Woldemar Tedernhorn and claimed to be of noble birth, stole a horse in Shakespeare and rode out, heading for Deming. Tucker went in pursuit, overtook the thief, and brought him back to town. While the deputy was gone, Sandy King took on a load of booze and terrorized the town. Arriving back in Shakespeare, Tucker arrested King and locked him up with Russian Bill in the shack that served as a jail. A miner's court went into session that very day in the dining room of Fred W. Beanbelly Smith's Stratford Hotel, located, of course, on Avon Avenue. Russian Bill was convicted of horse theft and Sandy King of being a damned nuisance. Both were condemned to hang, with execution of the sentences to be carried out immediately. Since Shakespeare had no trees, the rafters of the dining room were employed as gallows. The bodies were left hanging a full day as a warning to others. It was not recorded if Beanbelly, Smith's restaurant trade, suffered during that period. By the fall of 1881, the railhead town of Deming on the Southern Pacific Line, southeast of Silver City, had become the new Grant County hellhole. A gaggle of some 40 shacks and shanties squatting near the newly laid tracks, Deming had drawn toughs from every direction. "The cowboys, or roughs and thieves, are so numerous," wrote newspaperman C.M. Chase, who visited Deming that fall, that no man ventures any distance from the village without his Winchester rifle, ready to repeat 12 or 16 times without reloading. With this element constantly on the watch for plunder, a man's life goes for naught. Troubleshooter Tucker was sent to Deming. He wasted no time in letting the troublemakers know that the law had come to the railroad town. He was certainly the right man, said a visitor to Deming. For if he wanted to arrest a desperado, he was sure to either arrest or kill him. Tucker strode the streets with a double-barreled shotgun under his arm, according to one report. In 3 days after his arrival, he had killed 3 men and wounded 2 others. Within 20 days, he had arrested and jailed 13 members of the cowboy gang. One of those Tucker killed was Jack Bond, a rustler from the San Simon Valley of Arizona. A few weeks before, Bond and another outlaw named Lynn Peterson had enlisted in the ranger company of Captain George W. Baylor, stationed in nearby El Paso County. Their purpose had been to act as spies for a rustler gang operating in the brush country near El Paso and to keep the gang informed of the rangers' movements. When Baylor learned of the true character of Bond and Peterson, he dismissed them both. They went to El Paso, stole a pair of Mayor Joseph McGoffin's handsome carriage horses, and fled to New Mexico. Joined by a pal and Deming, they tanked up in a saloon and set out to hurrah the town. Whooping drunkenly and firing their six-shooters, they rode their horses through the office of the railroad hotel and into the dining room, scattering a large crowd of men and women recently arrived on the train. As they emerged from the building, Bond dismounted, threw his Winchester rifle across the saddle, and leveled it at the office. Just as at this juncture, Deputy Sheriff Tucker of Grant County appeared upon the scene. Covering Bond with a double-barreled shotgun, Tucker ordered him to drop the rifle and throw up his hands. The command was not heeded, and without any further parleying, the officer fired, landing 9 buckshot in Bond's body. The outlaw instantly fell to the ground a corpse. The other two, seeing the fate of their comrade in crime, sought safety in flight, followed by a shower of bullets. It is not known if either of them were injured. C.M. Chase, who visited the town shortly after that affair, wrote that the charge from one barrel of Tucker's shotgun blew the cowboy from his horse, while the other struck the dining room floor and remains there as a reminder of Deming's customs. The dead man was carried a short distance out of town and buried without any ceremony. He is indebted to Deputy Sheriff Tucker for his change of abode, said Chase, and 10 other roughs are similarly indebted to that officer, who is still in the harness and promises to rid the locality of the hateful element before long. Chase lamented the fact that men like Dan Tucker were in short supply. What is needed in southern New Mexico is 1 or 2 of such officers in every village and traveling on every train. The great trouble is that too many of the officers are, for consideration or otherwise, in collusion with the roughs and are conspicuously absent in the gambling halls and dance houses about the time the shooting begins. A report drifted back to Silver City that Tucker had been downed in one of his gun plays. There was a rumor on the streets yesterday that Deputy Sheriff Tucker had been shot and killed at Deming, but we were unable to have it confirmed, said the New Southwest, a Silver City paper, in late October. But the rumor was untrue. Tucker was still patrolling the streets of Deming with his shotgun, and within 4 months he would inform Sheriff Whitehill that Deming had been tamed. Deputy Sheriff Tucker is in town and reports everything quiet in Deming, announced the New Southwest on February 25, 1882. The word soon spread all along the border that Dan Tucker had put the clamps on Deming. Lawbreakers and fugitives gave the town a wide berth. According to one historian, Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, and their coterie of gunslingers in eastward flight from Arizona murder warrants in the aftermath of the Cochise County War, went out of their way to dodge Dan Tucker's Deming, although its location on the railroad afforded the quickest departure from the region. The Earp party went to Silver City instead, arriving on April 8, 1882. There, they sold their jaded horses and continued by stage to Fort Cummings and Rincon, where they caught the train north to Colorado. With Deming tamed, Dan Tucker augmented his income as deputy sheriff by riding shotgun on the Silver City to Deming stagecoach run. Recalled James H. Cook, who came to southwestern New Mexico that year as manager of the W.S. Ranch near Alma. The W.S. Ranch was at that time some distance from the railroad, Deming being the nearest railway point. A stage ran to Silver City each day, drawn by six horses. At the time of which I write, one of the Wells Fargo and Company's most noted shotgun messengers, Dan Tucker, helped guard the passengers and treasure carried by the stages. Tucker had some thrilling experiences with stage robbers in the Southwest. He had the reputation of being one of the bravest of the many gunfighters of the Southwest, Borderlands. Guarding treasure entrusted to the care of Wells Fargo and Company was a pretty hazardous occupation in that bandit-infested country at that time. Later in 1882, Tucker was involved in the most controversial incident of his colorful career, a shooting that would involve no fewer than five Grant County peace officers or former officers. On Friday, August 25, 1882, James D. Burns, a Grant County deputy sheriff stationed at the mining town of Paschal, was gunned down and instantly killed in Silver City's Centennial Saloon. Charged with the killing were City Marshal Gladius W. Moore, Deputy Sheriff William J. McLennan, and Deputy Sheriff Dan Tucker. Burns had come into Silver City from Paschal on Thursday and set out on a drinking binge that was still going on strong Friday evening. On Thursday afternoon, in front of the Walcott and Mills Saloon, he had made some show of his revolver, which attracted the attention of another deputy sheriff named Cornelius A. Mahoney. When Mahoney requested him to take off his weapon, Burns refused, saying he was an officer and authorized to carry it. About 5 o'clock Friday afternoon, Burns created a disturbance in Sam Eckstein's saloon, picking a quarrel with a man named Kerr and drawing his gun. Kerr, protesting that he was unarmed, backed out of the building. And Burns followed him to the door, six gun in hand. By nightfall, he had moved on to George H. Bell's Centennial. In front of that establishment, he fired his gun, apparently just to hear the sound of it. Hitching his revolver around in front of his belt so that he would be able to pull it readily when he needed it, Burns entered the Centennial and went in the back gaming room, presided over by house gambler Frank Thurmond. Investigating the shot, City Marshal Moore entered the saloon and found Burns seated at Thurmond's monte table. Also engaged in the game were John W. Gilmo, whom Burns had replaced as deputy sheriff at Paschal, and Dan Tucker. When requested to step outside with the marshal, Burns replied that he would when the game was completed. Moore drew his pistol and demanded that Burns give up his weapon. "Go away, I have done nothing," Burns said. In that tense situation, John Gilmo played the peacemaker's role, at least according to his later testimony. He implored Moore not to shoot and asked him to put down his pistol. The marshal holstered his gun, but immediately Burns drew his own six-shooter and backed off, saying again, "I will not go to jail. I have done nothing." Then Dan Tucker got into the act. From behind Burns, he drew his pistol and leveled it at the embattled deputy. With Tucker having the drop on him and Gilmo reassuring him that he would not have to go to jail as men could be found to go his bonds, Burns holstered his revolver and sat back down at the table. Marshal Moore was back outside, where he was joined by Deputy Sheriff McClellan. The two officers discussed the situation and then went to get an arrest warrant. Meanwhile, in the Centennial, Burns began to upbraid Tucker for involving himself in the difficulty. Gilmo later claimed that he again acted as a moderator in the quarrel. When Moore and McClellan returned, they entered by the rear door. They held revolvers in their hands, concealed under their coats. "Give up your gun. I have papers for you," McClellan told Burns. What then transpired is confused by conflicting testimony. Early newspaper reports were that Burns drew his pistol and fired a shot, hitting no one, and that Tucker was the first to react. The shot had hardly left Burns's pistol before Tucker returned the fire, hitting Burns in the left ribs just below his heart. The percussion from these two shots, fired almost simultaneously, extinguished all the lamps. McClellan then fired one shot, and Moore four shots in rapid succession at Burns, every shot taking effect. The death of Burns must have been almost instantaneous. A justice of the peace, Roelia, held a coroner's inquest in Silver City the next morning, and after listening to the testimony of witnesses, a jury decided that Tucker's shot had missed Burns and that William McClellan and G.W. Moore had caused his death. At a later hearing before Judge Lucas, the decision of the coroner's jury was upheld. Moore and McClellan were released to await the December session of the district court, and as the principal accessories to the killing were dismissed, the prosecution decided not to bring any action against Tucker. James Burns had been very popular at Paschal, and indignant miners there held a meeting on August 30th. A Silver City paper said that it had learned from the best possible authority that the meeting was called to make arrangements for lynching the officers implicated in the affair and would possibly have carried their design to execution had not a gentleman arrived who persuaded them to adopt a more sensible plan of subscribing money to help prosecute the men. The miners finally drew up and published a resolution condemning the cowardly, premeditated killing. Since they felt the murderers were apt to go unpunished because of a lack of prosecution and because of the protection given them by unprincipled persons in authority, they declared their intention to assist in prosecuting said murderers with all our ability and means. On September 3rd, a deputy sheriff, Richardson, attempted an arrest of Moore and McClellan in Silver City on a warrant issued by Judge Nickerson of Paschal, but they refused to submit to arrest, fearing to be taken into that hostile camp. They went instead to Central City, where McClellan had been stationed and Burns was unknown, and allowed themselves to be put under the charge of Deputy Sheriff Baldonado, who summoned a large posse of Mexicans to defend the prisoners in case of any danger. Although earlier indications were that no charges would be brought against Dan Tucker, he was also arrested and jailed with Moore and McClellan at Central City. On September 9th, the three were brought back to Silver City. No little excitement was caused in town last Saturday night by the arrival of Tucker, Moore, and McClellan from Central City, heavily chained and under a strong guard, reported a Silver City paper, adding that the three were committed to jail without bond to await grand jury action. Tucker was later arrested on a $2,000 bond, and eventually all charges were dropped in his case. By early October, he had resumed his post as shotgun messenger on the Silver City to Deming stagecoach run. Lawyers for Moore and McClellan secured a change of venue, and they were brought to trial in Las Cruces on March 26, 1883. Both were acquitted. The killing of James Burns was viewed in Grant County as a sordid affair that showed their peace officers are less than admirable characters. Sheriff Harvey Whitehill's popularity suffered as a result of his deputy's involvement in the Burns affair. In the election of November 1882, he was replaced by J.B. Woods. Whitehill's deputies, including Tucker, were all discharged in favor of men chosen by Woods. Tucker continued to work as a Wells Fargo agent on the Deming to Silver City run. On December 14th, he was almost killed in a Mexican brothel in Deming. As reported in the Enterprise, when Tucker entered the house, two women threw their arms around him. Thinking they were playing, Tucker struggled gently to release himself. But while he was being held, a man jumped behind him and pulled his revolver from the scabbard on his belt. Tucker at once threw himself upon the man, and a hand-to-hand conflict ensued. Tucker secured the weapon for a moment and fired it. Owing to his adversary's struggles, he missed, but slightly wounded one of the women. The other Mexicans present flung themselves upon him, and the man with whom he was fighting secured the weapon and shot him in the shoulder, shattering the bone and inflicting a very painful wound. Some Americans, attracted by the noise, entered the house and prevented Tucker from being massacred. The Enterprise account, published a week after the occurrence, said that Tucker was out of danger, although still suffering considerably from his injuries. The New Southwest, published 2 days later, said there were conflicting stories about the affair, and it was difficult to gather any particulars, but evidently Tucker fell among those unfriendly to him. The New Southwest said that two shots were fired at Tucker, one striking him in the arm, the other somewhere about the face, inflicting painful but not serious injuries. Dan Rose recalled that Tucker took a layoff from his messenger job and went to Silver City, still suffering from a wound that was slow to heal. A bullet, Rose said, had broken a rib under Tucker's right arm and lodged under the skin of his back. Tucker had planned to go east to have it attended to and to see his mother, but a new doctor came to town, cured him of his wound, and so he stayed on. After receiving that wound, Tucker could no longer bear the daily jouncing journey on the Silver City to Deming stagecoach, and he took a job as special officer for the Southern Pacific Railroad, finding the rails a much smoother ride. He was acting in that capacity in December 1883 when he and Captain J.B. Hume of Wells Fargo arrested York Kelly in Deming. Kelly was one of the gang who had held up the Bisbee, Arizona, merchandising and banking firm of Castaneda and Company on December 7th and escaped after the brutal murder of three men and a woman 8 months pregnant. Tucker and Hume arranged for the return of Kelly to Cochise County, where he and four Confederates were tried, convicted, and hanged the following March. By 1884, Tucker had gone into the saloon business. Old Dan Tucker has christened his new saloon at Deming the Eclipse, reported the Southwest Centennial on May 31st. He has opened the corner saloon fronting the depot. Tuck has many friends and is certain to do a good business. Visitors from Silver City may be relied to drop in on him. Later that year, he was a member of the Deming delegation to the Grant County Democratic Convention. In September 1885, Tucker was appointed Deputy U.S. Marshal for Grant County. 2 months later, during the Geronimo breakout of 1885, he and a companion named William Graham had a narrow escape in a brush with a war party. The two had been prospecting near Zuni Siding when they encountered six or seven Apaches. They made a run for the railroad siding in their buckboard, with the Indians in pursuit. Armed only with six shooters, Tucker and Graham took cover in a boxcar, which the Indians circled for some time, staying just out of pistol range before riding off. In October 1887, Tucker made an unusual arrest, nabbing a wanted fugitive walking beside the track while he was himself aboard a moving train. As explained in the dimming headlight, Tucker had been asked to apprehend one Dave Thurman under bond for horse stealing in Sierra County, who had skipped out. The officer expected to overtake the flyer between here and El Paso, but missed him. Returning homeward Sunday, Dan, from the engine cab, spied his man plodding alongside the track. Tucker had the engineer slow down the train, and before Mr. Thurman realized the situation, he had to make a choice between a bullet and surrender. He chose the latter and is now safe in the Hillsboro jail. Soon after that, Dan Tucker left Grant County, moving west to California. He was reported to be a resident of Los Angeles when he revisited his old New Mexico haunts in May of 1892. Dan Tucker, one of the best peace officers Grant County ever had, returned recently from California and has been in Silver City during the present week, renewing acquaintances with old friends, announced the Enterprise. He has grown so fleshy that his friends hardly knew him. When Harvey Whitehill died at Deming, September 8, 1906, he was honored and extolled for his service as sheriff of Grant County during those early turbulent days. None of the accounts mention Whitehill's deadly deputy and troubleshooter, Dan Tucker, the man who had meant so much to Whitehill's success and who later died, his contributions forgotten, in a county hospital in San Bernardino.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.